The Spectator is Europe's fastest growing current affairs magazine. Subscribe today and find out why. You'll get 12 weeks in print and online for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of Spectator gin worth £30. So if you do the math, you'll work out that is absolutely free. Go to www.spectator.co.uk/gin.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week, a few of our favourite writers read out their pieces. This week we'll be joined by the German historian Katja Hoyer, Spectator editor Fraser Nelson, and our associate editor Toby Young. First, Katja Hoyer, on who Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, really is.
Ursula von der Leyen looks every inch the modern European stateswoman. Her tailored trouser suits, no fuss hair, and assured speeches. What's not to like? When she was put forward by the European Council for president of the European Commission, her fellow Germans knew precisely what to expect. A poll found that only a third said that she'd be good at the job. Martin Schulz, a former president of the European Parliament, did not mince his words. Von der Leyen is our weakest minister, he said. That's apparently good enough to head the European Commission. Having served as the deputy leader of Angela Merkel's CDU party from 2010, she consistently achieved the lowest re-election results in the role's history. Merkel had found a loyal protege in von der Leyen. She'd given her a hand up out of regional politics in Lower Saxony and onto the federal stage. Under Mutti Merkel's protection, von der Leyen retained her place in the cabinet longer than any other politician, despite various political scandals. She is perhaps best known for her reforms of the German military, an exercise in dubious procurement contracts that saw consultancy firms paid millions of euros while overpriced equipment failed to materialise. Just a few months before she quit as defence minister in 2019, US officials found that German forces had been using mobile phones during a NATO exercise because of a lack of encrypted radio equipment. Meanwhile, the Bundeswehr was forced to scrap its standard-issue assault rifles when it was discovered that they didn't shoot straight in temperatures above 30 degrees. At one stage, German soldiers were performing military exercises with broomsticks rather than guns. Von der Leyen hails from the closest thing the European Union has to an aristocracy. Her father Ernst Albrecht was the CDU's minister-president of Lower Saxony, as well as one of the EU's first civil servants. His young daughter seemed unsure of what she wanted from her future. She studied at four different universities, switching between archaeology, economics and medicine. Her wild years seemed to have come to an end when she was awarded a medical doctorate in Hanover in 1991. However, a scandal erupted in 2015 when it was alleged that nearly half the pages of her dissertation contained plagiarised material. She reached her political nadir in 2018 when even Merkel was ready to drop her erstwhile ally as the CDU's defence policy came under even more intense scrutiny. There was a lifeline from Brussels. Tellingly, von der Leyen announced her resignation as defence minister before her appointment as president of the European Commission was confirmed. The fact that Merkel abstained from voting on her nomination shows just how toxic her former deputy had become. Some in Brussels suspect that Emmanuel Macron wanted a weak candidate so he could mould her and the continent in his own image. This may explain it. The EU leaders wanted someone who looked plausible but was ineffective at running a European Commission that they did not want to become too powerful. By that measure, she was the perfect candidate. Perhaps now, as the Commission fails to deal with the pandemic, it will regret this decision, looking at the trail of mayhem she has left in her wake, and it seems that she has not finished yet.
That was Katja Hoyer. Now, Fraser Nelson on what he thinks the Defence Review tells us about what Britain has learnt about its foreign policy.
Like most Prime Ministers, Boris Johnson has grown fond of deploying the military, albeit so far on the home front. Enthused by the army service and the London Olympics, he turned to the troops when the pandemic struck, and 101 Logistics Brigade has been embedded in the government ever since. The soldiers distributed PPE to frontline workers in March last year, and this year have become an integral part of the vaccine rollout. The military don't moan about health and safety regulations or a 40-hour week, one minister told me. Everything just works. Well, the future of the military was, this week, laid out in a blueprint billed as the biggest strategic rethink for a generation. This is normally Whitehall code for huge cuts, but what's strange this time is that the defence budget is about to have its biggest rise since the end of the Cold War. The army is still shrinking, but the thinking behind this is not so much to break from the cycle of recent failure, but from the cycle of pretense, from the myths politicians tell themselves and the public about what the army can really do. Ben Wallace, who I used to know in the Scottish Parliament, is the first Defence Secretary for decades to have served in the army. He left the Scots Guards for politics just as Tony Blair's wars got underway. Britain, in those days, was running into battle behind America, but with a fraction of the resources. And I saw the consequences for this myself, shortly after the invasion of Iraq. Britain pretended to take charge of Basra, the second city of Iraq. And Britain failed, leaving a security vacuum which was soon filled by Shiite death squads. Barbers were executed for shaving beards. Basra's morgues were filled up with the mutilated bodies of women accused of un-Islamic activity. When Des Brown was Defence Secretary, he arranged a photo shoot with the governor of Basra to show the world that the city was safe. I went along with him, and I can testify that the photograph itself was a vast pretense. We travelled there in armoured vehicles. Troops had closed off every street within a 500-metre radius, and each entrance was guarded at gunpoint. The city was absolutely not safe, but the photograph was designed to suggest otherwise. The cup of tea with the governor lasted about 15 minutes before the army evacuated back to base far outside Basra. I remember going to the loo there, and there was a piece of graffiti written by the soldiers. "Been off base yet?" it said. "Deserve a medal?" The soldiers themselves knew that they'd been posted to Iraq, but they were literally 10 minutes away from a city where people who badly needed their help, but they were unable to give that help, confined to base, told to keep up a pretense. This was all to spin a story, that peaceful Basra was being handed back to the Iraqis. Of course, it was run by the Iraqis before the invasion. What happened in the end was that when Britain left Basra, we effectively surrendered that city to the Mahdi army. Once the British evacuated, Basra had to be reinvaded by Iraqi troops and its people liberated again. Now, all of this matters because if you're deciding the future of defence, you need to work out why did this failure in Basra happen? Why was the British army defeated by insurgents on the ground in southern Iraq? Why were we so badly equipped in Afghanistan? One of the soldiers I was with in Iraq was later killed by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. He was in the Snatch Land Rover used in the Belfast era. The Americans in those days were transporting each other by helicopter to avoid the roadside bombs, but the Brits couldn't afford to do that because we didn't have the kit. Yet again, a failure. And yet again, it was due to the fact that in Whitehall, Blair and Cameron were kidding themselves. A conspiracy of optimism was at work. Soldiers were unrealistic about the prospects in Iraq. Afghanistan and Libya too. Politicians were overly hopeful about what could be done on a thinly stretched army. And the army are trained never to cry for pain, never to say we can't do it, never to say stop. The idea behind the latest defence review is to end this pretense. So the idea is there's going to be a bolstered assessment centre called SONAC to conduct wargaming, apparently, and red teaming. This is military speak for making sure that unrealistic military deployment doesn't happen again. There's a new focus on the wars of the future, in which low-cost drones are bought by insurgents and used to take out British tanks. Already in Yemen, we can see Houthi rebels managing to get their hands on Iranian ballistic missiles. So the conflicts of the future could be ones where the adversaries are low budget but still able to make serious damage on expensive British standing armies. So the MOD thinks, let's cut back then, standing armies. They've also been struck in the MOD by the emergence of private defence companies like Wagner Group, thought to be funded by the Kremlin and operating in several African countries. Now, how do you fight against an enemy that doesn't carry a flag? When Putin invaded the Crimea, he used troops without identification. So these sort of private defence companies, according to Putin anyway, are, as he puts it, a tool for the realisation of national interests without the direct participation of the state. Now, There always have been mercenaries and private security firms, but Wagner Group is of quite a different order. It's run by Dmitry Utkin, who was previously a Special Forces Lieutenant Colonel in Russia's Military Intelligence Service. It offers its clients airfields, even disinformation campaigns. Facebook said recently that it removed 274 fake accounts promoting pro-Russian narratives to people in places where Wagner Group operates, in Mozambique, Sudan, and Syria. To the MOD, of course, this is a great example of a new asymmetry of warfare, and a problem that won't be remedied by a large standing army. So the idea is, nowadays, to deploy smaller forces in more places to deter adversaries from adventures, and also to invest more in the military overall. Defence spending is going up by 14%. Now, set against rampant inflation in the defence world, this still won't be enough, hence the cuts to the standing armies. The cuts raise an obvious risk, which has been mentioned by several retired military chiefs. If you weaken the existing army, you invite new conflict. As Donald Rumsfeld once put it, weakness is more provocative than strength. So the risk of conventional war is low for any country who is likely to win a conventional war. Soften the defences and the equation changes. Provocation is more likely. So with his new military strategy, has the pretense really ended? First, talk about a new naval base in somewhere like Singapore. Now, if that were to happen, it would be a hugely expensive undertaking, and it just doesn't look right on current budgets. It's also a stretch to think that any committee of technocrats would or could veto any prime minister wishing to deploy. If there was an imminent threat, as we saw when Colonel Gaddafi was getting ready to bomb rebels in Benghazi, the prime minister will, of course, have his way. The military, at the time, advised David Cameron against the Libyan adventure, and they were overruled. It doesn't take long, normally, for prime ministers to discover their inner Churchill. Before David Cameron was number 10, he was using semi-pacifist language, mocking those who, in his words, wished to drop democracy from 40,000 feet. Now, he didn't do that. When he was in Tripoli, he sought to drop it in Libya from 1,000 feet, and even then he failed. Libya is now a collapsed state in which the Wagner Group is happily operating. The Foreign Office even fears the Kremlin may use its influence in Libya to encourage the flow of illegal immigrants over the Mediterranean and destabilise Europe that way. So Boris Johnson's response to this is the largest ever military budget in modern times, but the smallest ever army. Smarter, smaller deployments. Now, if his new Sonic committee advises against deployment, he says that he'll exercise the restraint that David Cameron and Tony Blair lacked. But is he deceiving himself? With Joe Biden in the White House, who is a far more interventionist president than Donald Trump, it might not be long before the call to arms comes from Washington. When it does, then we'll see if Churchill's biographer is able to resist.
That was Fraser Nelson. And finally, Toby Young on dogfights.
I was walking with our one-year-old Cavapoo Sean on the way back from the Baker's in Acton on Sunday morning when I spotted a man with two greyhounds coming towards me. At least, I think they were greyhounds. They looked like they'd been injected with steroids, making their muscles grow and pop and giving their faces ravenous, desperate expressions. Just as well he's keeping those dogs on the lead, I thought. Sure enough, as soon as they spotted Malinky, they went crazy, barking, squealing, straining at the leash. Did they mistake her for a rabbit or a rodent of some kind? Mally looked terrified, as if she knew she'd been earmarked as a Scooby snack. Then one of the beasts broke free and started bounding towards her, saliva spilling from its jaws. I'll return to this story in a moment, but to put it in context, a six-month-old chihuahua was killed by a boxer pit bull in Acton Park last month. The owners managed to separate them, but by then Bobby's ribs and skull had been crushed. The vet couldn't save him, and now, on a nearby park bench, there's a little shrine to the poor fellow, complete with a bunch of flowers. The owner was understandably traumatised. She relayed the story on the local next-door group to warn others of the danger. Quote, "We will never get over this, as he was our child, devastated and heartbroken. He was a tiny, happy little boy who loved everyone," unquote. She asked for witnesses to come forward because the owner of the pit bull did a runner. My next-door neighbour had a similar experience a few years ago. She was picking up her son from John Betts, a local primary school, when a red setter attacked her poodle, Maddie. Another mum bundled them into the back of her Chelsea tractor and sped to the nearest vet, with my neighbour administering mouth-to-mouth on the back seat. In this case, the vet was able to save the dog, but only after she'd had brain surgery totalling £10,000. Maddie's still alive, but she's not about to win Crufts. She has a bite-sized chunk missing from her skull, making her head look like the Apple logo. The rogue greyhound was only about 20 feet away when he broke free and was already trying to fasten his jaws around Mally's head by the time I was able to react. I whisked her up off the ground and cradled her in my arms, turning my back on the other dog to use my body to protect her. It was no good. The greyhound leapt in front of me and tried to prise Mally from my hands in a frenzy of bloodlust. I lifted her as far above my head as I could in an effort to keep her out of harm's way, and the other dog started jumping up in the air, jaws snapping. At one point, he tried to scramble up on top of me to get to her and bit me on the shoulder. Luckily, I was wearing a coat and his teeth didn't break my skin. All the while, Mally was yelping in fear and wriggling to get free, her flight reflex kicking in. I'm not sure how long it was before the greyhound's owner managed to pull him off and reattach the lead. It felt like an eternity, but in reality it was probably just a few seconds. He asked if my dog was okay, and I inspected her for bite wounds and couldn't see any. "Have you definitely got him under control?" I asked, before putting Mally back down. The responsible thing would have been to get his name and address and report him to the police, but I don't suppose he would have given them to me. He was a squat, heavily built man, with the same predatory look as his greyhounds. As I walked the rest of the way home, I shuddered to think what would have happened if another member of my family had been in the same situation. Caroline might have been able to fend off the dog, but my two youngest sons and my daughter wouldn't have. That would be a double whammy. Not only would Mally have been injured or killed, but the child would have been racked with guilt afterwards. I thought a little dog would be quite low maintenance, and so she's proved to be, but I hadn't anticipated the danger that she might be eaten by a big dog. That risk is heightened in an area in the throes of gentrification like Acton, where the parks are shared by yummy mummies with lapdogs and working-class men with pit bulls. A great combo if you're the owner of a local vet, but a bit of a nightmare for us small dog owners.
That was Toby Young. Thanks for listening to this episode of Spectator Out Loud. And remember, you can pick up an issue of The Spectator to read pieces like this and more if you go to www.spectator.co.uk/gin to get a free bottle of gin with your Spectator subscription. That's www.spectator.co.uk/gin. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.